Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck.
More than 500 industry people gathered in Jackson this week for the 17th annual Wyoming Oil and Gas Fair. Wyoming Public Radio's Energy and Natural Resources reporter Stephanie Joyce was there, and she joins us now to talk about the event. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Bob.
So what are the biggest issues on the mind of Wyoming's oil and gas industry right now?
Well, I think taking a look at the very big picture, one of the takeaways from this event is that the oil and gas industry feels like it's under attack. The event kicked off on Thursday with a keynote address by former Vice President Dick Cheney, and he didn't mince words at all. He said there's a war on fossil fuels, and while he was referring specifically to the Obama administration in that case, the rest of his speech made it pretty clear that he thinks the opposition is more pervasive than that. And he wasn't the only one at the conference to employ the war analogy. Governor Meade spoke right after the vice president, and he actually spent most of his time talking about coal, specifically the war on coal. And he did acknowledge that it was a little strange to be talking about coal at an oil and gas conference. But his point was that the industry needs to be paying attention because, his words, they'll be next. So there's definitely a sense among folks here that the oil and gas industry has a lot of battles ahead and that it needs to get ready for those.
So what kind of strategies are they proposing to do that?
Well, the specific strategies are kind of all over the map, but it seems like underpinning all of them is a call for better communication, particularly about issues that have been a thorn in the side of the industry, like fracking and water use. There were at least three presentations yesterday dedicated specifically to reshaping the stories around those issues. And one in particular that I found interesting was by John Harpel with the Colorado-based natural gas brokerage Mercator Energy. His firm recently wrote a study about the economic benefits of fracking for people in lower income brackets, and that got picked up by the Wall Street Journal. So he kind of presented that as a case study in changing the message about fracking, and then he tried to coach the attendees through the process of building up a positive message. Here's how he summed up his presentation.
And I share this, you guys, not because it's about me, but it's how one little effort can kind of go viral, and we can open up the discussion about hydraulic fracturing beyond where we've had it before.
And that desire to reshape the public message was echoed by several other presenters as well. Ken Knox with Noble Energy talked about the water issues surrounding fracking and how to reframe some of those. Stephanie White with HDR Engineering talked about how companies can start shaping public opinion about their projects during the review process, and how they need to be doing a better job anticipating concerns and developing strategies for addressing them. And, you know, Bob, I can imagine that you're thinking all of this is pretty basic, you know, kind of no-brainer, but judging by the audience reactions, this is something of a new conversation in the industry.
So what were some of the other big issues that came up at the meeting?
Well, I think the other big topic at the meeting can sort of broadly be summed up as the future economic prospects for the state's oil and gas. Currently, Wyoming ranks third in natural gas production in the United States, and right now most of that is being shipped, you know, to other states around the country with energy deficits like California and New York. But fracking and other unconventional recovery techniques are really unlocking the natural gas resources all over the country, and in many cases much closer to some of those markets. So the demand for natural gas from Wyoming and other Rocky Mountain states is really falling through the floor, and that's been reflected in the price of natural gas over the last couple of years. And it's not a situation that anyone expects to get better anytime soon. So everyone I've heard from here at the conference is really looking to natural gas exports as the way forward. Porter Bennett with the consulting firm Ponderosa Advisors put it this way: there's simply no way for us to consume domestically the amount of energy that we're projecting to be producing by 2020. And this is a little wonky, but here's how he explains why that is.
It's being driven by production in liquids or oil-based regions. Why is that important? It's because the price of gas is largely irrelevant to the decision to drill in those regions. It's the price of oil that's determining that. So as long as the areas that are oily and liquids prone produce as much gas as they are, the gas volumes are going to stay up, even though the rig count in dry gas areas declines.
So what he's saying is that so long as the oil is valuable, drilling is going to happen in natural gas-rich areas, regardless of the price of gas. But of course, the industry and the state don't just want that gas to go to waste. So they're going to be looking for markets overseas, primarily in Asia. And we've been hearing a lot about the coal export terminals in the Northwest, but I think we'll be hearing a lot more discussion of natural gas export terminals in the near future.
You did mention oil. Certainly, that's been somewhere in our discussion recently. What did they talk about the future of oil in Wyoming? Was it discussed?
That was definitely discussed. And, you know, amid all the talk about the somewhat dismal prospects for natural gas, quite a few people were saying that the state's oil future is pretty bright. Oil production in Wyoming has been declining since the 80s, but last year there was a bit of a bump. And in a presentation, Nick Scoville, Anadarko's Powder River Basin manager, said his company sees a lot of potential for growth in oil. He says they've currently got 30 rigs active in the basin and that the oil side of their business is making up almost half of their revenue right now. So this is definitely a time of transition for the industry. We've all heard that fracking really changed the game, but that's definitely not the only change ahead. If the industry analysts who spoke at the meeting are right, fossil fuels aren't going away anytime soon, and in fact, we might be about to see a lot more development of them, both here in Wyoming and across the nation.
Wyoming Public Radio's Energy and Natural Resources reporter Stephanie Joyce in Jackson this week at the Wyoming Oil and Gas Fair. Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Last week, we ran a story concerning proposed cuts in the Developmental Disability Waiver Program. The belief is that there are some in the program getting more money than they need. Advocacy groups and those in the program worry that cuts could actually take money away from those who need services. Senator Charles Scott is the chairman of the Senate Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee. He joins us to explain the legislature's position on the issue.
The rules, when they first did it, were structured to accommodate the most severe cases and make sure that they had available to them all the services they needed. And what's happened over time is that a lot of people who were not that severe a case were getting all these services that were things that you would need with a real severe case of developmental disabilities, but didn't need for their particular case. The consequence of that was the program was costing so much that we didn't have enough money for it, and we'd built this great big waiting list of almost a quarter the size of the number of people that were on it. And we tried in the 2012 budget session to put some more money in to reduce the waiting list, and we got beat. The legislature wouldn't do it. We passed a reform bill last time where what we're trying to do is have a waiver with just some of the basic services that everybody would need on it, and then one that was more comprehensive for the people that were the more severe cases. There are going to be some people who lose some services that they would like to have, but they don't necessarily need. The department has redesigned things several times, listening to the problems they've got, and put some provisions in that will make the transition a little more gradual, get people adjusted to it. And when you do something like that, and it's going to require a good deal of judgment in individual cases, you can almost be certain that the bureaucracy is going to get it wrong every now and then. So we inquired at the last Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee meeting as to the appeal process. And there is one. It should be effective. So when the bureaucracy does make a mistake, take away something that somebody absolutely has to have, then that can be remedied.
One of the things P&A has brought up to me is that they're concerned that there aren't enough people who are in the field or experts that would review some of those appeals. Is that a concern?
That's always a concern, but I think a little common sense and maybe there may be some things where changes get delayed pending the ability to hear the appeals adequately. I think we'll probably be all right.
Do you think that there's a chance that once you go through this process, the department looks at these cases very closely and does make some trims, that there might be an opportunity down the line to add more money into the program?
Yeah, I think if the department has made a good and sincere effort and has said, look, we can't get enough out there to reduce the waiting list enough, then you've got a better case to go back for more money. But if the department were to just roll over and say, okay, we aren't going to change anything, the answer would for more money would continue to be no. You know, this is a welfare program, and we do it because when you get a child with a severe developmental disability, that's beyond the ability of the ordinary Wyoming family to afford the care that they need. So we've added them to the Medicaid program, which is the, you know, health care program for the poor. And it makes sense because what you're saying is that the ordinary folks don't have enough resources to take care of some of the real special needs that are out there. But it does mean that you're asking everybody else to pick up what's fundamentally somebody else's responsibility. And it's reasonable to say, let's keep it down to what people really need. And then there's always going to be a dispute over what that is. There's some real severe cases out there. We've all seen them. And those are expensive to take care of. It's going to be an expense that the society is going to have to take. The alternatives are totally unpalatable.
Senator Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Natrona County Senator Charles Scott is the longtime chairman of the Senate Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee.
When we come back, we'll hear from an expert on education and the brain and hear about the UW School of Pharmacy. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. In this time of job insecurity and a changing medical landscape, the University of Wyoming's School of Pharmacy Education is graduating dozens of doctoral students who, for the most part, can count on securing a good-paying job once they get their degree, if not before. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
Walgreens Pharmacy, this is Sarah, pharmacist. How can I help you?
Sarah Pence is a pharmacist at Walgreens in Laramie. She says her store fills hundreds of medications on a daily basis, and there's a lot she loves about her job.
For the most part, it's being able to talk to patients individually, to be able to, when they have questions about their medication, and you can elaborate, and they get this look, and they're like, oh, no one's ever told me that. It's really good to know. I've been taking this for 20 years, and I didn't know. And so I really enjoy being an educator and helping people, and that's probably the most fulfilling thing.
Pence spent 2 undergrad years getting her prerequisites in order and 4 years in the University of Wyoming School of Pharmacy to get her doctorate of pharmacy, which became the new standard for pharmacists in the year 2000. Pence is 25 and graduated last year. She had less trouble than many other people her age entering the workforce.
I had the job landed before I graduated, so no problems there. It's really just going out there. There's pharmacy jobs everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Linda Martin is the dean of UW's pharmacy school. She estimates that 90% of graduates find jobs immediately after graduation. That's actually a small drop from a couple years ago, but the rate seems to have stabilized.
And the salaries are maintaining. The salaries are very high, probably around $100,000 to start.
Although doctors are disease experts, Martin explains that pharmacists are drug experts, and they're becoming more important than ever for a number of reasons. Chronic diseases are treated more aggressively today. People are living longer, and baby boomers are aging, requiring more medication. New medicines come out all the time, and pharmacists have the specific knowledge about which drugs work best and how they'll interact with other drugs, food, sunlight, etc. UW's School of Pharmacy has competitive admission standards.
We're limited on our sites for our internships, for we call them rotations, so we do have to limit our program to 52 students.
That means pharmacy students have small class sizes and lots of face time with their full-time professors. Students do at least 11 internships in various pharmacy settings before graduation, and as soon as students enter pharmacy school, they're allowed to work part-time in a pharmacy, filling prescriptions and counseling patients under the watchful eye of a pharmacist. Second-year pharmacy student Brian Martetius works part-time as an intern at Walgreens with Sarah Pence. Martetius has worked in pharmacies for over a decade, mostly stocking shelves and counting pills, but he wanted to be able to do more.
There are huge gaps in my knowledge base. I have more questions now than I have answers. The main reason I decided to go to pharmacy school was just to fill in the information gap, to figure out why stuff is done the way it is.
There are about 140 fields of pharmacy practice, and retail or community pharmacies are only part of the picture. Pharmacists work in prisons and nursing homes. They help write public policy. Many also work in hospitals. UW Assistant Professor Kara Harshberger advises doctors about medications at Ivinson Memorial Hospital. Third-year students intern with her to learn about how to identify relevant information in patients' charts and how to talk with them about it. Harshberger says pharmacists rarely make it into the spotlight, but it's important for them to be knowledgeable and attentive because drugs are serious stuff. For example,
we use a lot of drugs that are toxic to the kidneys, and if we're not appropriately adjusting those for how well your kidneys are functioning, you can have permanent kidney damage, or you can have more toxicity in other side effects because the drug's not being eliminated through the body correctly.
Dr. Lou Hoheiser is the CEO of St. John's Medical Center in Jackson. He has been following the implementation of healthcare reform carefully, and he says doctors are overloaded with work and are embracing more of a team approach to treating and monitoring patients.
We can do a way better job of keeping people, particularly with chronic illness, out of the hospital, making sure they're taking their medication appropriately, making sure there's no side effects because they're taking two different medications that aren't compatible.
Hoheiser says as efficient and effective treatment become more important in American healthcare, he only sees pharmacists becoming a more integral part of the team. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
On October 2nd, the University of Wyoming College of Education will be hosting University of Southern California professor Dr. Mary Helen Imerdino Yang, who will be the keynote speaker at the annual Elbogen Symposium for Teaching and Learning. She will discuss how emotions shape learning, motivation, and self. Dr. Imerdino Yang is an expert on neuroscience and education. She says emotions and our social experiences are a big part of learning.
You literally think and learn because there's some kind of emotional attachment to that thought or that thing that you've learned. You value it in some way. And that value could be intrinsic for the information's applicability to your life and or for your inherent interest in it, or it could be extrinsic. It could be something that a teacher says, if you don't learn this, then you're going to flunk the test and everybody's going to be mad at you and we're going to think you're not a good student and you're going to have to stay in from recess, right? So the thoughts that you have and the feelings that you have about those thoughts are completely intertwined with one another.
So what does a teacher take from that? And let me just use maybe a personal example, math. For years, I'm probably a normal American and feared math, and because it wasn't easy. And so you initially have some bad experiences with math, and maybe you just assume that, well, this is just something I can't do, and, right. and I'm going to struggle. So as a teacher, how do you work the emotions to get a kid out of that attitude and help them learn?
You've had all kinds of emotional experiences with math. So we think of math as being something, you know, sort of cold and purely cognitive and separate from our emotions. But what you're telling me is that emotion, you know, is totally intertwined with your knowledge and ability to do math and your motivation to do math, right? In your case, it's a negative association. What kids need, what teachers need to be able to facilitate and foster in an effective classroom environment is emotions around math that are constructive and that are conducive to learning high-level mathematical concepts. So those emotions, like fear and like anxiety, are not conducive to high-level learning. But emotions like interest and like excitement and like a sense of challenge, those are conducive to high-level learning. So teachers need to find creative ways to help kids build constructive emotions in academic domains. Find ways for the kids to genuinely feel the excitement of understanding in a new way or of thinking in a new way. And one sort of pitfall that can this can be taken sort of in the spirit I don't mean it, is that a kind of easy way out to get the kids to feel positive emotions is to kind of reward them from the outside, you know, throw candy at them is the worst example. And there what you're doing is in some ways potentially actively undermining their ability to feel like intrinsically motivated emotions about the mathematical content. And instead, you're superimposing these really salient emotions about wanting to get rewards from the teacher or to get stuff. And what you really need, what a really skilled teacher is able to do, is share their love of the disciplinary thinking with the kids. Take the kids inside their mind with them and say, this is what it feels like to use math from the inside and to think like a mathematician. And this is an inherently fun process if you develop the appropriate skills to be able to manage it and use it to solve problems you care about. And that's a very, very tricky thing to be able to do, but that's what the very best teachers are able to do.
It's interesting you say that. We can all remember maybe the college teacher or two that was able to do that on a particular subject.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And so is it more training for the teachers so they can get themselves emotionally involved in some of these topics?
Good teachers, talented teachers, really are artists. They have to be very knowledgeable about their subject matter. They also have to really be able to take the perspectives of the learners in their classroom and imagine how it feels like to think like them within the domain that they're trying to teach, and then try to adjust the way that they assign things and explain things so that they can really facilitate the kids experiencing the material in a constructive way so that it feels engaging, so that it feels meaningful to the kids in a real and sort of genuine way. And I think a lot of times teachers don't appreciate, and in large part this is not their fault, it's only very recently that scientists appreciate, emotion is so completely infused into our cognitive abilities. So teachers often feel like bringing the emotional side into the learning process is kind of an aside or a waste of time or something extra. But in fact, what we now know scientifically, and especially neuroscientifically, is that literally for the brain to learn something, it has to care about it. You can't learn something that you don't care about, that you have no reason to remember. And so they need to find reasons for the kids to care about the math, and they have to be reasons that are intrinsic to the math and not sort of extrinsic, like, well, then you can go to a good college, or, well, then I'll give you a candy at the end of the week. You know, candies at the end of the week can get you, you know, to sort of step over the first step and start trying to engage with the math, but they're never going to turn you into a real mathematician. Real mathematicians do math because they love math, because they think it's such a fascinating topic. We need to find a way to share that with kids.
I have so many more questions I wanted to ask you, but we're out of time. Mary Helen will be speaking at the UW College of Education. It's the 2013 L. Bogan Symposium for Teaching and Learning. She'll be the featured speaker at 4 o'clock Wednesday, October 2nd. We're looking forward to having you on campus, and thank you so much for joining us in Open Spaces.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
When we come back, the emotional trauma that suicide survivors go through, and we'll hear more on the debate over delisting grizzly bears. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. Wyoming consistently has one of the highest rates of suicide in the nation, and the state is working hard to change that. One of the reasons that suicide prevention efforts are so important is because of what suicide does to the family and friends of the victim. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports that the grief survivors go through can be much more acute than other types of grief.
On December 10th, 2010, it occurred to Dan Hedrick that he hadn't heard from his brother in several weeks. That wasn't altogether odd. His brother was a solitary person, mostly kept to himself. But for some reason, Hedrick found himself wondering if everything was okay.
The next day, I was headed into town. My phone rang, and my mom said, can you come up to the house? Your brother shot himself.
When Hedrick got to the house, the police were already there. There was no note, but the coroner said it looked like a suicide. Hedrick says he's still trying to wrap his head around why his brother killed himself.
He had had an injury on an accident with Union Pacific that really wasn't covered and was in a lot of pain. That's the story we tell ourselves. As a survivor, you keep trying to grasp at straws to make sense of it.
Hedrick says not knowing why his brother killed himself has been one of the hardest things to deal with. After his brother's death, he did his best to be strong, to help his mother and sister cope with the loss. But in the process, he bottled up his grief until it finally bubbled to the top.
I got to the point that I was constantly annoyed with everything without knowing why I was annoyed. Simple things would make me mad and cause me to react in ways that I normally wouldn't react.
And little things would bring back the pain, like his brother's new driver's license arriving in the mail.
6 weeks after he passed away, up pops a letter with congratulations, you've got your license, and a picture of him just before he died. You know, there's always those little things that kind of trigger the pain coming out.
Anyone who's had a loss goes through a cycle of grief. But UW psychology professor Carolyn Pepper says suicide survivors often have added emotional trauma.
They're also probably experiencing feelings of rejection and abandonment, wondering, why did this person do this to me? And that can go along with anger. They might have guilt, wondering if there's something that they should have done, if they should have seen this coming and done something differently.
And there's often a sense of isolation, because friends don't necessarily know how to respond.
So even their friends sometimes pull away because they don't quite know what to say or how to be of help.
Pepper says survivors often feel a sense of shame, and so they avoid talking about what happened.
It's a hard thing to say, my brother killed himself.
You know, the thing we struggle with suicide is that there's stigma around suicide.
Teresa Humphreys Wadsworth is the state suicide prevention coordinator. She says people often assume that someone who commits suicide has some sort of character flaw, and she says that keeps survivors and their friends from talking about it openly. Pepper says that makes it harder to get through the grief, harder to heal.
That could lead into things like depression, alcohol and drug abuse problems if they're trying to use substances to numb the pain, and even in some cases, suicide themselves.
But Humphreys Wadsworth is optimistic that things will change.
You know, it hasn't been that many years ago that we couldn't say the word cancer, that was a word we whispered behind our hand when someone died. And now people talk about it openly. And I know that at some point, that's where we're going to be with suicide deaths.
Humphreys Wadsworth says what's needed is a major public education campaign. She says people need to understand that suicide victims are not flawed human beings. They just can't see any other way to get past the problems in their lives.
Once we understand that, it takes away that judgment that goes along with stigma.
And she says when that happens, survivors may start to talk more openly about what's happened and get the support they need to recover from the loss. The state is already working to educate people about the warning signs for suicide and teach them how to help if someone is considering ending their life. And Humphreys Wadsworth hopes to expand those efforts in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants grizzly bears taken off the endangered species list, but the agency's effort has been blunted by the courts. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that the debate continues.
In 1975, government officials worried the West could one day be grizzlyless. Using the Endangered Species Act, the government became a great protector of the bears that play a vital role in the region's ecosystem. But by 2007, the federal government recorded a massive rebound in the population, so they delisted grizzly bears.
So we believe the grizzly bear is a substantial success story.
That's Dan Ash, the head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says revitalizing the grizzly population in Wyoming and throughout the Yellowstone National Park region reveals the difficult yet somewhat simple mandate Congress gave the executive branch in 1973.
When you think about the objective, you know, of the Endangered Species Act, the purpose of the Endangered Species Act is to prevent extinction of species.
But while federal officials were popping champagne, they ran into a problem: federal courts. Conservation groups sued, and the courts sided with them, arguing global warming was threatening bears' ability to sustain a healthy population. Currently, grizzly bears are still called endangered, yet their numbers are up, and officials report an uncomfortable rise in bear-on-human encounters. Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso says that's why the law needs to be revised.
Well, this shows how detrimental the Endangered Species Act has been to actually helping deal with the problem.
Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis agrees. She says a part of the problem lies with Congress for allowing the Endangered Species Act to lapse.
We should be delisting the grizzly bear and then toasting it, having a celebration because the grizzly bear has recovered.
Lummis says the other half of the problem lies with judges.
The courts have actually been making law. So it's time for Congress to get back involved, to reauthorize the act in a way that improves the act rather than destroys the act.
Environmentalists see it quite differently. They argue grizzlies' numbers are still unknown, and they fear a delisting would allow states like Wyoming to allow humans to once again start hunting the animals in droves. Bonnie Rice of the Sierra Club says delisting is just too big of a gamble.
There are very, very few places where these bears can exist, and we're incredibly lucky to have grizzly bears in Greater Yellowstone. And so in the face of all these uncertainties, though, about the trends in the population and the changes in habitat and the changes in food sources, we don't think now is the time to remove protections and to risk its full recovery.
And court orders are court orders. Fish and Wildlife Director Ash says now his agency has to reassess the population and make its case anew.
So we're going back, we're doing a comprehensive assessment, and we're preparing to reconsider the issue, and if we feel that it still warrants it, then we'll re-propose to delist in spring of 2014.
There's another snag for Ash, though. The federal budget cuts, known as sequestration, have slashed his bottom line.
The dollars to do the science, it takes the people on the ground to convert that into sensible management strategy and direction, and right now where we are with budgets and sequester is just it's difficult to see how we're going to do that.
Now the Fish and Wildlife Service is spending precious resources to redo a study that agency officials know the answer to. And while Wyoming lawmakers want to tweak the Endangered Species Act, no serious effort is afoot in this divided Congress. So for now, many in the environmental community, and presumably those grizzlies, are the ones popping the bubbly. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
National AARP President Rob Romasko is in the state this week for some activities with the Wyoming chapter of the organization. There's a lot going on. He joins us from Casper.
Well, let's start with Social Security. As you know, one of our former U.S. senators is a big fan of your organization and has certainly talked about reforming that system. I mean, what about that issue? Is there room for compromise? Is there room for reform?
Well, I think the issue is what's the problem we're trying to fix, and how does it fit in the overall context of retirement? The facts are that Social Security is fully funded at the current level of benefits through the year 2033. If we do nothing, everybody acknowledges, Senator Simpson and everybody else is correct in saying benefits would drop to 75% of its current level. So first of all, anybody that says Social Security is broke is exaggerating. It's not broke, And in fact, it would still pay 75% of the benefits if we did nothing. I don't think that's acceptable to anybody. So the question is, how do we close that fiscal gap? And we advocate having a separate conversation about that and not confusing fixing Social Security or meeting its financial challenges with the budget deficit, which is an equally serious problem, but the two are different. Social Security is the only federal program that has its own funding source. It doesn't dip into the general treasury. The money that's taken out of everybody's paycheck goes into a separate account, and that fully funds the program. So how do we think about that going forward? So the question we want to get people to understand is, going forward, Social Security had basically three legs in the stool: our pensions, Social Security, which is a minimum benefit, and whatever personal savings that you were able to accumulate. Well, over the next, we've seen how pensions are basically going away. It's becoming harder and harder to save. So the question arises, so why would you cut benefits? We've already raised the retirement age. We had a significant adjustment about 25 years ago, which created these surpluses. So what are the options we have, and what kind of benefit structure do we need? And that's the conversation we need.
Rob, when we look at, when you hear so much about Medicare and what might happen, I'm kind of curious how much of this is, you know, just some angst about just the ACA and some other things going on, or if this is being used as a bargaining chip in some way. I'm curious if you really do think things will happen there and what that might be.
There's a lot of misinformation flying around, and some powerful people are saying some very untruthful things about it. Medicare does have a challenge, more immediate fiscal challenge, which is there's a lot more of us aging. We tend to use a lot of medical services as we age. So that's an important pressure on Medicare. The other issue is a broader issue, which is healthcare costs in general. This country spends $2.7 trillion on healthcare, everybody. We are 50% more expensive than every other industrialized nation, no matter what kind of system they have. Our health outcomes aren't particularly stellar. By the 19 measures that international evaluators use, we're 37th. So we're spending the most per person. Our outcomes aren't that great, and we accidentally kill 200,000 people a year through medical errors. So the real question is, how do we focus on healthcare costs in general and bring those in more in line with the regular economy? If we were able to do that, about half the problem that Medicare represents in the federal budget would go away. That doesn't relieve Medicare from, are there reforms that could be made? And we believe there are reforms in Medicare that would slow the cost increase and not harm member benefits.
You could just enlighten people on just a couple of the key ideas you have.
Well, I think, again, keeping with the idea that Medicare reforms can be made and still not harm or introduce benefit cuts, which I think is really the issue. Pharmaceutical companies are forbidden to negotiate with Medicare on prescription drug prices. Just think about that. Medicare is probably the largest purchaser of drugs, and they're forbidden to negotiate with the pharma companies. That's like telling Walmart they can't negotiate with Procter & Gamble over the price of Tide. So there's savings there. Generic drugs can be brought to the markets faster, which are less expensive. There's certainly, and we're happy to have endorsed the PRIME Act, which is a bipartisan piece of legislation designed to cut down on fraud. There's still a lot of fraud in the Medicare system. The Affordable Care Act has improved that. So there is a host of things that can be done that can generate literally billions of dollars worth of savings in the Medicare system. So there are efficiencies in the system, different ways of structuring the system, and the payment scales, which in fact will reduce the cost and not harm beneficiaries.
Rob Romasko is the national president of AARP.
Coming up, we take you into the world of women's roller derby. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Modern roller derby is a contact sport that features two teams roller skating on a track, attempting to score by passing players of the opposing team. While the sport's origins can be traced back to the beginning of the 20th century, it was revived in the early 2000s in Texas by women and for women. Since then, teams have started up all over the world. Wyoming has been a late adopter of the sport, but women here are making up for lost time. Wyoming Public Radio's Chelsea Biondalillo reports.
Let's celebrate her initial turn. She makes it through. That is a grand slam, folks.
Recently, skaters from all over Wyoming, Colorado, and Nebraska met up in Cheyenne for a multi-team derby tournament, which gave skaters a chance to mix and match teams and practice their skills. Just as in the public bouts, the skaters are using pseudonyms, called derby names, and are wearing costumes inspired by burlesque fashions, including tutus and fishnet stockings, in addition to their helmets and other safety gear. Derby is well known by its fans for being a full contact sport, but unlike other sports, most teams will train any willing skater, even women who have never roller skated before. Friends and family call the coach of Casper's team Vera by day, but on the track she's known as Fatal Distraction. Distraction says that the inclusion roller derby offers appeals to many women who have been left out of traditional athletics.
You ask any one of the girls and they'll tell you it's their favorite workout. It promotes athleticism, health, you know, endurance, camaraderie. It's amazing that way. It becomes such a community and such a part of who you are.
But once on a team, many women find that derby offers women something else, the freedom to take on a fearlessly competitive persona. Bomb Dylan, as she's known, skates for Laramie's Naughty Pines Derby Dames. She came to Laramie for two reasons, to attend the university and get on a roller derby team.
I think it offers the opportunity to be far more aggressive and unapologetic about that. I mean, even like girls lacrosse, you can't make contact, but in men's you can. In derby, I mean, you could be aggressive, you could be kind of sexy, you can be a lot of different things.
But Punish Her Page of Casper's Deadly Ghosts says that the physical contact is only part of the freedom of derby. The costumes and derby names are also important.
A lot of it is you just have your alter ego on top of that name. You are who you are at work during the day. They call you by your first name. You know your last name. You get on the track. You get to put all that aside. Everything you wanted to do and try, just let it out and go for it.
All right, everyone, who's ready for some roller derby?
Many skaters are quick to say that their lives have been changed by roller derby. Panty Waster, or P-Dub, as she's known to her teammates, skates for the Cheyenne Kappa Dolls and says that meeting beautiful, tough women from all over the state and the sense of sportsmanship they share is what keeps her coming back.
The word empowerment is kind of overused in roller derby, but that really is what it gives women, and it gives them some strength and I think some attitude also.
Strength, attitude, and a community rich in diversity. Debbie Mercury skates double duty for both the Naughty Pines and Kappa Dolls.
You know, I've met so many wonderful, strong women in this sport. People from all walks of life, teachers, lawyers, doctors, you know, people in radio, everyone. And we all come together and hit each other really hard and have a good time.
Jamie Gooch is a referee for the Laramie League, but he's better known on the track as G.I. Jameson. And he's first and foremost a fan.
Oh, it's really fun to watch. It's really fun to actually get into it. There's only a close second for me, and that's watching my college football.
There are several teams across the state, two of which are recognized nationally by the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, and more who plan to pursue membership. While derby bouts don't draw the same crowds as football games, at least not yet, the teams take their sport just as seriously as any gridiron player. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chelsea Biondalillo.
In this installment of Wyoming Stories, Stephanie Reitner interviews her neighbor, Noel Richardson, both residents of Jelm. Richardson worked for the Forest Service in 1957, spraying trees for beetle kill around Cody and Yellowstone. He remembers a chef that cooked for the camp. The chef named Phonograph Jones was in his 80s then and had also cooked for Buffalo Bill Cody and Prince Albert, the first on his trip to Wyoming 100 years ago. His great-grandson, Prince Albert II, is in Wyoming this week.
They had a couple of lady cooks, and we drove them off. That we were just, there were all these rowdy young 18, 19-year-old kids. So they hired another cook, and I've seen his name in print since then. His name was Phonograph Jones. He was in his 80s, and he had cooked for Buffalo Bill and the Prince of Monaco when Buffalo Bill took him cooking or hunting on Pahaska and some areas like that back more in maybe in the 1910s, in that first decade of the 20th century, I suppose. And old Phonograph was probably in his 80s then. He was a little bald-headed guy, bow-legged, ex-cowboy. Good cook. He could really cook. And they kind of told us, if you run off this cook, we're going to get a new crew and keep the cook. But it was no tense. Phonograph had a meat cleaver. And when he told you you were doing dishes, it was best not to argue. He's a pretty tough old bird. He was an awfully good cook.
What did he cook? Do you remember? What was your
favorite? Yeah, I cook a lot of stuff. He made an applesauce cake that was to die for, and it was steak and potatoes and everything. But we actually had a day off. It was a holiday, but we didn't go to town. We were so far out. And he did a whole turkey dinner. And just turkey, stuffing, dressings. He had a big tent with a couple of big wood-burning ranges. And a cherry pie for dessert was my favorite. And he cut those big cherry pies in four pieces. And I ate one of those.
God.
And then I mistakenly made a comment that I believe I could eat a whole pie. And so when the bets were all in, it was like over $20, which at that time was like 2 days' wages or something like that. I don't know. So I did it.
You ate the whole pie?
Mm-hmm. After the turkey dinner. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But I wasn't allowed to, upchuck. So I had to kind of very carefully get to my bunk and lay down for quite a while. Didn't eat cherry pie for quite a while after that.
Oh, my gosh.
But I did do that, yes, absolutely. Yeah, Phonograph was the case. I saw in a Wyoming Wildlife, there was an article talking about some people cowboying or something up in that country or hunting. I don't remember. And he referenced one of the cowboys was Phonograph Jones. And that was his name. And the Phonograph had to do with an old Phonograph or something that he had or something like that. But, yeah, he was just a regular cowboy, wrangler type of guy at that point. And he had an enamel coffee pot on the stove like this. And he just sat there in that wood-burning heat stove in that tent, which he kept pretty hot. And it just stayed there. And then he'd just add grounds and add water. And he wouldn't empty it out about once a week. And you better not say anything about the coffee. I'm not kidding. One guy, and I don't remember what he said, but he said something about the food, and it wasn't complimentary. And that old meat cleaver hit that table, big old wooden picnic table right beside him, and he said, I want to put you on dishes tonight, and not a word, boy. I don't think he had any fear at all.
Meat cleaver, like...
He hit the table. He hit the table. Whack.
Oh, my gosh.
On the end of the wooden table. And that's a for sure that happened.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh,
yeah, it was. I mean, it was pretty funny if you were about a half a table away. If you were too close, it was time to be really quiet. Yeah, nobody laughed much, I don't think.
That was Stephanie Reitner interviewing Noel Richardson.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual segments, or listen to previous episodes, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces.
You can also submit ideas for future programs on that website and comment on our stories. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.